You never know who could be in the White House. Could someone be there that would actually take away all of our rights and begin arresting us for who we are, what we think, what we read? And so I consider this to be one of the most important pieces of legislation that we'll put forward.
While all of Washington, D.C. is captivated by the testimony of former FBI Director James Comey, Senator Rand Paul, who calls the Trump-Russia investigation a distraction away from more important issues, is busy working on some of those issues having to do with civil libertarian concerns on criminal justice and surveillance. This week, he's introducing a new piece of legislation that would bar the federal government from holding U.S. citizens indefinitely without a trial. We're here at the Russell Senate Office Building today. We're going to talk to him about that and more.
Well, we're excited this week to be introducing a law or a potential law, legislation that would stop the government from indefinitely detaining someone. This came about because, well, really, it has a long history. We detained the Japanese without trial, which was a form of indefinite detention back during World War II. Unfortunately, some of the courts even upheld this. And then back in the 70s, we passed, back in the 50s, and then again modified in the 70s, another act called the McCarran Act was passed to try to limit the president and say, hey, you know, the president shouldn't be allowed to detain people like the Japanese or any other group of people without any kind of trial. However, they left a loophole. They said the president can't do it unless Congress wants to do it. And so along comes another law a few years ago, 2011, the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, and in it, it had language that said, because we're so fearful of being attacked by terrorists, we're going to set up this provision where we could hold people without a trial. So it's not only not a speedy trial, as the Sixth Amendment says we should have, it's no trial at all. Basically, you're just held indefinitely. Now they say, oh, we'll give them a habeas hearing, which means sort of a habeas corpus, present the body. You got to say, bring them forward and tell them what they're accused of. But as I always remind my colleagues, that's the beginning of jurisprudence. That's not the end. Present the body and say what they're accused of is the start of what you're supposed to be guaranteed. You're supposed to have a lawyer, a day in court, a public trial, a judge, the ability to confront your accusers, et cetera, et cetera. But in 2011, they passed this authorization out of such great fear of terrorism. They said, no, we just got to be able to do this. And my response to them at the time was, do you mean an American citizen? Does that mean an American citizen could be arrested and sent to Guantanamo Bay forever without a trial? And the response from Senator McCain was, yeah, if they're dangerous. And my response to him was, it sort of begs the question, who gets to decide who's dangerous and who's not? And I think most people who have looked at our legal history and jurisprudence in general would say, you know, one of the great protections against arbitrary power is the ability to have to, you know, to have a trial to defend yourself if you're accused of something. So I consider this to be one of the most important issues of individual rights probably that's confronted us in recent times. And it didn't start with this issue. I think it started with Korematsu and maybe even a longer history than that. But I think most people remember the Japanese internment. Out of that fear and out of World War II, they passed more acts saying, gosh, we're just going to be able to, well, maybe we should limit this a little bit, but I think we're at the point where we need more. So our legislation would say that neither the president or Congress can indefinitely detain someone without a trial, without the protections of the Constitution. And I think this is an important thing for us to bring up. We've had a couple of votes on it. About 2 or 3 years ago, we had a vote in the Senate, and it actually passed with 67 votes. But if you watch Washington, the main thing to know about Washington is it's not always what it appears. It went to the conference committee. So if the Senate has one version, the House has another version, it goes to conference committee, and mysteriously it disappeared. So even though we were able to get 67 votes not to detain American citizens, to guarantee that you have a trial, it was stripped out. And I'll never forget President Obama's response. He signed the legislation. You know, he ran with some sort of intent of saying he was for civil liberties. And some of the things he said when he ran, I think I admired. But then he signed it and he said, well, not to worry. You can trust me. I will never use it. And kind of remind me of Madison's admonition. He said, you know, that you can't rely on government to be comprised of angels, basically. You know, the rules, the chains of the Constitution are to, you know, to make sure nobody can have so much power. And it really isn't about you. It's about the next guy or the next woman who could be worse and more authoritarian. So I consider this to be very, very important because you never know who's next. You never know who could be in the White House. Could someone be there that would actually take away all of our rights and begin arresting us for who we are, what we think, what we read? And so I consider this to be one of the most important pieces of legislation that we'll put forward, and it's to prevent indefinite detention without a trial.
How would you assess the kind of the climate, the political climate for that right now? I'm thinking of Theresa May a couple of days ago said that, you know, we should probably trade civil liberties to be more safe in the wake of terrorism. I think the current administration here shares some kind of feelings with Theresa May. Do you feel like you're in a better place? We are in a better place to react to terrorism this way and to be cognizant of constitutional liberties in 2017 than we were in 2013.
I think your point is well made that the fear of terrorism grows with each attack, and there's always people wanting to trade their liberty for security. And so I'm not saying it's necessarily better than it was a couple of years ago. It may be worse. I do think, though, that some of the things on surveillance in general may be leaning our way because some of the surveillance may have been used by the previous administration for political purposes on the current administration. That may well help us in maybe trying to reform things like FISA and the 702, the backdoor searches where all Americans' records or many Americans' records can be looked at without a warrant. There may be some benefit because of sort of the partisan squabbling over that. On this particular issue, I think there always are people that feel they say, gosh, we've got to be safe. But then when you kind of remind them, you know, we are talking about something fairly important here, and you remind them of what happened to the Japanese. What happened to the Japanese is a powerful historical story that still attaches. And you talk to people in California and the representatives from California, it's a very, very strong sort of pull. I think the current senator, Senator Feinstein, I think was old enough to actually remember some of that as a child. And do we have the momentum to be able to do it? I don't know. It's so important that whether we can win or not, it's worth discussing. It's worth trying to bring up to get those who are concerned with civil liberties, to get them motivated to call, write, get online, write stories about it. Because even though it's not been used, it's an incredibly dangerous power to allow the government to have the power to indefinitely detain you without a trial.
On the surveillance thing and in the current political climate, did you see Lindsey Graham's quote from, I think, 2 days ago that he's now suddenly interested about 702 in a way that he hadn't been before?
I agree. And I've talked to other people on the intelligence committees, and typically those who are on the intelligence committees are rubber stampers of the intelligence community. They're not at all skeptical of power, other than a few exceptions. So I think the fact that we have Lindsey Graham now saying that, he might consider that you have to get a warrant to look at information of Americans. And that's the idea that's floating around. It's a very simple one. Any database that has Americans in, if you want to type an American's name in, get a warrant. And a lot of people say, oh, how could we ever catch terrorists? You need to realize that even when you have to get a warrant, most warrants are issued. You know, think of in D.C. tonight, if there's somebody that is inside their house, but their neighbor says they went in 4 hours ago and someone says they saw them, they think they saw them raping someone down the street. How often do you think a judge says no to a warrant? Almost never. So, I mean, judges are fairly compliant and we kind of want them to, but we still want it to be separated such that there's someone who isn't in the pursuit of the chase, doesn't know the people involved, doesn't know the color of their skin, their race, anything about them. You want an objective individual, you know, to make those decisions. And then Sixth Amendment talks about, you know, speedy trial, right to trial, et cetera. The interesting thing about the Sixth Amendment, and this is something we've gotten quite involved with as well, is the story of Khalif Browder really shook me. You know, he was a young 16-year-old that was accused of stealing a knapsack and spent 3 years in Rikers Island, 2 years in solitary confinement. And every time I think about it, I'm horrified. 2 years in solitary confinement with no trial. So the Sixth Amendment says you get a speedy trial. We're working on that issue from a couple of angles. One is that bail, and I've started talking with Senator Harris, Kamala Harris from California, about this. He had a $3,000 bail. So a lot of people can afford a $3,000 bail. In fact, many people you know will say, well, I'm not leaving my kid in jail with $3,000. But what if you have no money? Absolutely no money. Bail is supposed to be about your risk of fleeing, but it's also supposed to be individualized. You know, it's different for a billionaire than it is for somebody that's a greeter at Walmart. There's a difference in circumstances about what is the deterrence to flight. But for him, it was permanent incarceration. You know, he was beaten and all kinds of things happened to him. He tried to kill himself in prison. It must have been a horrific experience, you know, and then ultimately he did commit suicide. But that's a big part. That's not a speedy trial. In fact, really, if there ought to be any trial, it ought to be over somebody who kept him in prison for 3 years without a trial, because that's absolutely an injustice. Yeah, I think there's very little of this Attorney General, this Department of Justice, doing anything favorable towards criminal justice or towards civil liberties. Why did I vote for him? You know, politics is funny, and I think a lot of people out there, because I've seen some of the criticism, they tend to sort of discount the things that we are for and do in legislation and think that it's much more important who you and supported in a particular primary or how you vote on a particular nomination, as opposed to, you know, the dozens and dozens of fights that we fight every day for, you know, for individual liberty. And I think we pick and choose sort of which fights we're going to really expend our effort on. So, for example, I expended a lot of effort, and in fact, I think I did have some impact in blocking John Bolton and Elliot Abrams from being at the State Department. Those I thought I had a chance with, and we did. We did everything possible, and I did probably three dozen television interviews saying they were unacceptable and that they didn't agree with President Trump's belief in less regime change and less intervention. And we had effect. If we'd have tried to do the same on Sessions, I don't think we'd have been effective. I don't think it would have worked. And I think any replacement would have been somebody sort of equally from the same school. And so we didn't feel like we could win. We also felt like any replacement would be from the same perspective or worse. And I think it also plays into the fact, and this is something that's hard for people outside to see, is that when you're with people every day that you have lunch with every day, there's a certain personal rapport and belief in the individual that may not translate to the, to all of their positions as well.
And although the law required no reason at all to fire an FBI director, the administration then chose to defame me and, more importantly, the FBI.
Comey's testifying right now. We'd be remiss not to ask you about it. Tie it even back to your work on civil libertarian stuff. How does this scandal, his testimony, affect the climate for dealing with surveillance issues and things like that from your...
I don't know how much effect it's going to have on other things. I think that right now the distraction of all things Russia and all things Trump-Russia is distracting us from everything right now. And I think it has been overplayed. I mean, sounds like, and you can just imagine this, if you've watched the president, he's sitting there with Comey and he's saying, am I a target? And he says, no, Mr. President, you're not a target. Tell the public then. Why won't you tell the public? You can see him browbeating him and saying, I want the public to know because it's distracting from my agenda. And you do kind of wonder if he really isn't a target, why they wouldn't say that publicly. And you can go into all the debate over whether or not he was bringing undue pressure on him. But the bottom line is as Comey testified today, nobody told me never not to investigate this stuff. Anybody else for a last follow-up?
So why are we selling arms to the Saudis? Can we stop this?
Next week we'll have legislation on that as well. And the legislation from the 70s, the Arms Export Act, allows one senator to demand a vote. And so I will demand a vote on that. Senator Murphy is my ally in this. We have a bipartisan. And I think we have a decent chance at having a very good showing in the vote and possibly even in winning the vote. It's a vote of disapproval, and it would say to the administration they can't sell the arms. Now, unfortunately, like every other bill, it has to be signed by the president, so the president could veto it and still do it. But winning a battle like this would send a huge message out there. And I've been making the point, because, you know, we're also talking about sanctions against Iran, that if you don't want Iran to develop ballistic missiles, maybe we shouldn't be giving more weapons to the Saudis, because the Iranians then say, well, the Saudis now have more, we need more. And there really is an arms race. Every time Israel gets more or the Saudis get more, the Iranians want more, and vice versa. And it goes back and forth and back and forth. And I also think the Saudis are contributing to a humanitarian disaster. There's 18 million people living at starvation levels in Yemen, and it's just horrific to read the stories of what's going on in Yemen now. And the Saudis are stoking it. They use our bombs to bomb a funeral procession about 6 months ago, 150 dead and 500 wounded. And we think, well, gosh, is there going to be an end to terrorism from that? No, maybe 10,000 more people want to blow themselves up after seeing this horrific civilian death. Anyway, I appreciate the time today, and it was a great interview.
While work on the indefinite detention bill is just beginning, a vote on the Saudi arms deal could come as soon as next week. For Reason, I'm Matt Welch.